This is Upfront, dispatches from the new majority. I'm Sandeep Roy. Coming up, race and the race. Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee for president.
You know, I think if we're realistic about this, race is the issue in this election.
What a real Latino can or can't do.
Sneaking a taco at Taco Bell is pretty common.
Novelist Dagoberto Gil. Sometimes a roof over your head is, well, just that.
The toilets are all overflowing. The ceiling is leaking sewer water.
Life on the fringes of the economy. And making music out of sacred texts. But first, these views from the ethnic media.
In Zacatecas, dos jóvenes de 15 años
en Japón, Both
were made to gangsters and
With a roundup of views from the ethnic media, I'm Odette Keeley. This week, why Russian-American voters like John McCain, and Arab voters are excited about Barack Obama. And a veteran Philippine broadcaster and her crew are abducted. Philippine TV news anchor Cez Drilon, her crew, and a local professor were kidnapped last Sunday in the country's southern region. It's suspected that they are being held by the Muslim extremist Abu Sayyaf group. Drilon is with one of the country's biggest broadcasting networks, ABS-CBN, which declined to comment. Filipino-American website Inquirer.net not only made this their top story, it also dedicated an entire section to track the developments of this case. U.S. Sales Director Esther Chavez explains the importance of this story for their readers.
Cez is a big name in the Philippine broadcast. And for her and her team to be kidnapped in Sulu is big news because it entails the military, the local government people, and then there's ABS-CBN. And the whole country's in tune with this ongoing drama because the plight of the journalist in the Philippines is really something to be worried about.
Esther Chavez from Inquirer.net, the official news website of the Philippine Daily Inquirer, the Philippines' most widely circulated broadsheet. The website is constantly updated and partners with many leading news organizations in the Philippines and the world. With Hillary Clinton out of the running, some Russian-American media say a significant number of the readers may favor Republican presumptive nominee John McCain. Senior editor Ari Kagan of Evening New York says some younger Russians support Barack Obama, but many older Russian-Americans don't.
And one of the reasons is Barack Obama passed. He just recently left Trinity Unity Church in Chicago. But for 20 years, he was closely affiliated, connected, and friendly with pastors of this church who expressed anti-Semitic, anti-American, racist views. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of Russian-speaking immigrants have doubts about Barack Obama. Also, he is not a household name. He doesn't have close connections to Russian community like Hillary Clinton had. He never appeared in the Russian community. He never gave any interviews to Russian language media.
Ari Kagan edits Evening New York, a Russian language weekly newspaper that has a circulation of 10,000. Publisher Ray Hanania of National Arab American Times newspaper explains why Arab American voters hope Obama will be the next president.
He had announced that he was going to bring change. That was the big thing. And of course, for Arab Americans, the big deal is we want change. So I think there was this initial, hey, this is going to be great. Maybe the change we'll get will be fairness.
Ray Hanania says America's foreign policy compels many Arab American voters because
all of the candidates seem to pander, you know, to the pro-Israel vote. In other words, they look at the presidential election almost exclusively from a very narrow perspective in terms of what will these presidential candidates mean for the future of the Middle East? And then the other issue, of course, is the war in Iraq. will these candidates really be able to deliver on their promise to bring, you know, to end the war, you know, which we view as Arab Americans? That really is a war, but more of an American occupation of another country.
Ray Hanania of the National Arab American Times newspaper. It was launched this year and can be found at more than 600 Arab American stores across the country. For more stories about the ethnic media, visit us on the web at newamericamedia.org. I'm Odette Keeley.
This is Upfront. I'm Sandeep Roy.
The way to continue our fight now, to accomplish the goals for which we stand, is to take our energy, our passion, our strength, and do all we can to help elect Barack Obama the next president of the United States.
With those ringing words, Hillary Clinton endorsed Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee for president. I was watching the telecast at the museum, the News Museum in Washington, D.C., and people all around me, random museum goers, burst into spontaneous applause. And it made me really feel that all the cynicism of politics aside, perhaps this was a historic moment after all. Today on our Ethnic Media Roundtable, we'll talk about that and what it means for the race going forward. My guests are Tammy Johnson, Race and Public Policy Director at the Applied Research Center and contributor to Color Lines magazine, Emil Guillermo, columnist for Asian Week and blogger at Amok.com, and political analyst and syndicated commentator Earl Afari Hutchinson. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thank Good you. To be here.
Now, Barack Obama for a while seemed to have really tried to run above race. And Emil, in a column in Asian Week, you write, Obama has brought on a new way of viewing people of color in America. It's as close to the MLK Jr. dream of colorblind as it gets. What do you mean?
Well, I think he's been so race averse, meaning he's never really wanted to talk about it openly. Race is almost a subliminal thing. It's almost as if he says, look at me, it's pretty obvious I'm a multiracial person, or that could be a black or white person, I suppose, in his case, but he doesn't really want to talk about it. He's a race avoider, because if you want to be charitable, you say he's trying to be above it all. If you're trying to be critical, you say he's trying to avoid a real hot-button issue. If you're a politician, I guess you do want to avoid the hot-button issues.
Tammy Johnson, would you agree with that? I mean, how do you see the covert and the overt dialogue around race changing as the campaign moves forward now?
You know, I think if we're realistic about this, race is the issue in this election. The only question is, how will Obama deal? Now, the political inclination would be to duck the issue or to personalize it. But if he's really about the change he talks about, then he needs to be bold enough to speak directly about the racial and gender inequities that are out there, so he's relevant to both communities of color and women, but also address those fears of white men who think that when you talk about those issues, you're excluding them or they will have to lose something. Because the reality is that the systems that hold people of color and women back also hold economically poor white men back as well. So if he's really about change and he really wants to win this election, I think he has to step it up and talk about race and step it up to the level of talking about systemic racism and how it works within institutions and what he's going to do as the leader of this country to change that and move it away or move it to, from the level of just being about a personal issue about him.
But do you see him doing that at all, Tammy?
So far, not so much, to be quite honest. But, you know, I also want to say he's surrounded by an infrastructure, both in the Democratic Party and the media PR specialists that we all see talking about framing issues, whose dogma has been for decades, do not talk about race, duck the issue. He's not going to be able to do that.
Earl Afari Hutchinson, how successful can Barack Obama be in trying to stay above the fray here? In the views section leading up to this, we heard from a Russian editor talking about how Russian Americans are dubious about Obama for various reasons. There was an op-ed in La Opinion that said Latinos had to deal with the race issue. Are you hearing more and more people coming out and say race is, in fact, going to be the issue, as Tammy suggests?
Actually, no. I'm hearing just the opposite. I think from day one, we certainly knew that race could be an issue, probably would be an issue. And I think when you really look at Obama's campaign, and actually strengths of the campaign, is he has deftly and adeptly stayed away from it. The whole premise of his campaign, even in his slogan, is hope, change, and unity. Essentially, that implies that this is a broad-based, really an issue-driven campaign. I'm almost the candidate, not just for hope and change, but also the candidate for every person, kind of the every man, every woman candidate, really something for everybody. And when you look at it from strictly a political standpoint, he had to do that. If he came off, and this was understood from day one, if he came off looking and sounding like an Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, at least being perceived that way in the minds of many who have issues with him, and certainly those issues tend to be along racial lines, if he came off looking like that, his campaign was DOA. It's not going to go anywhere. So he understood, we have got to strike the broadest chord possible. We've got to appeal to the broadest segment of voters possible. And the political reality in America is about 80 to 85% of those are still white. Now, we saw one thing in the primaries, which even reinforced that even more, that tendency to be the every person candidate. We saw in the primaries in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, and to an extent, North Carolina. Four of those he lost, one of them he won. But we saw something, about 20 to 25, in some areas even higher than that, 30-35% of white Democrats, blue-collar whites, rural whites, middle-aged, older, middle-income women, over 50, flatly said in exit surveys and polls and flat-out in interviews, if he's the nominee, we're not going to support him. Now, if they're as good as that threat, there's a problem of division and polarization in the Democratic Party.
In fact, there is a group formed that was called Democrats for McCain. There's definitely a lot of women who were angry about Hillary Clinton not being the nominee. When Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, everybody talks about healing the Democratic Party, Emil, what can Obama actually do to actually heal the party?
Well, I thought before Ms. Clinton bowed out, I thought maybe the easiest way to heal the party was for them to come together, this idea of a dream ticket, although such a dream ticket would have to come with a pretty heavy prenup, I think. But I don't know what Obama needs to do to woo women. I think that there were enough women to back him to, you know, detracted from, from Hillary, but, you know, Hillary still was seen as the women's candidate. I don't know if the women are going to do it for him. I think he's got to deal with the white men. I think he's got to deal with the blue-collar crowd, and I think he's got to deal with people who are on the fence. I agree with Earl. I think it's sort of unfortunate that, you know, those of us who focused on race for most of our journalistic careers, you know, we'd like to see him talk more about race because there are serious issues that need to be discussed. But for him to be successful, it's almost like he has to take an anti-race kind of position. And I just don't know how it's going to play out.
But people have said during this run-up that sexism was maybe still more acceptable than racism, at least admitting to it publicly. Tammy, do you agree with that? Or do you see this kind of fiery racism is actually coming out of the closet, as it were?
Well, you know, I really don't think it helps anyone to get into the whole oppressing ladder discussion about what's the most oppressive racism or sexism. Because the reality is that he's going to have to deal with that when people go to the polls anyway. You know, the whole issue of what kind of strategy is his campaign going to come up with to deal with the Southern strategy that we see come out every presidential election year. Where, you know, where it is Glenn Ford or somebody else, the fact that he's a black man is definitely put up front Southern white voters, especially male voters, as a reason why to come to vote. You know, the question is, will he be proactive and get ahead of that, or will they try to deny that race is an issue and not really deal with the race issue of a Southern strategy?
I mean, it's undeniable that whether it had been Clinton as the candidate or Obama as the candidate, someone or the other would have been angry There was no getting around that. But are we underestimating how angry some people are at who is the ultimate candidate?
You know, you asked a question before about what could he do. Actually, there are some things, not that he can do, but he's going to do and have to do. There is an issue, I think, with rural, but especially blue-collar whites. Historically, traditionally, they were called Reagan Democrats. Now the new term or the buzz term is Hillary Democrats. Many of them don't like him, and they were very clear about that, and they gave reasons why. However, a percentage of them also have issues with home, foreign foreclosures, job, high unemployment. We know about the gas prices. Many of them have issues with the Iraq War. In other words, the economy, stupid. We hear that over and over again. And now foreign policy, stupid. We hear that all over again. Like any Democrat, he's going to have to pound on that, hammer on that. He's going to have to somehow figure out a way by just repeatedly hitting these issues and hope against hope that it resonates enough with some of the resistant Hillary Democrats and the bigoted, biased Democrats that enough of them buy that and say, these are our interests. We got problems with Bush. We certainly are going to have those problems with McCain and the GOP. If they're in there, they're not going to go away. So essentially, if they buy that, he's got a shot. There's something else that he has to do, too. I never bought the Hillary-Obama dream ticket. I think it would be a nightmare. I think the better ticket would be this. And I think you'll see this. He's going to have to, and this is not going to make some people happy, but remember, we're talking politics and political expediency. He's going to have to pick a conservative, centrist, Democrat, white male, a Sam Nunn, a Chuck Hagel, a Jim Webb. He's going to have to pick him as his running mate for this reason. One of the major attack points against Barack Obama has nothing to do with race. It has everything to do with inexperience, national security, the war on terrorism, and foreign policy issues. So he's going to have someone by his side to parry that. And that someone would be one of those individuals or a type like that that can put up their credentials. Hey, I'm strong on national security, terrorism, defense preparedness.
Emil, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think Earl has a good point there. For those of the people in the audience who believe that the only man suitable to be president is a person suitable for sitting on a statued horse on Massachusetts Avenue, I think it would be helpful to have someone with a little more experience, maybe war experience, a conservative. But I think this is also something that John McCain is investigating, and I write about it in my column this week in Asian Week, the possibility that maybe Bobby Jindal, the Louisiana governor, may be chosen to be McCain's running mate, to be sort of the anti-Obama. If McCain has to fear the fact that he's perceived as older and not terribly with it, here's Jindal who comes around, who's young, a change agent in the GOP, and a man from the South. Jindal's practically a shot of Viagra for John McCain. And I think that also presents an interesting specter for Asian Americans, because Asian Americans who were for Hillary Clinton will now have to figure out, is it worth it to back Obama when you have maybe a McCain-Jindal ticket, the first Asian American who possibly could be, president, a heartbeat away from the presidency? So, I think if McCain did that, it would be an interesting wrinkle. And people who've read my columns know I'm no fan of Bobby Jindal. But I think that he does represent what I call...
He could make the race interesting.
say the least.
Well, Tammy, you get the last word. And the vice president, what's your dream ticket here?
we're still talking about the Democratic Republican Party, so I don't know if I can have a dream ticket. But I think one element that we would be remiss if we didn't bring up is the Latino vote in this. They are in significant numbers in major states that mean a lot, like Texas and California and New Mexico. And both Obama and McCain have issues around immigration that could work for and against them. So, this is also an issue that Obama needs to really rethink and get very clear on, because in certain states, they could be the key votes. And that also really tells us that we need to be very vigilant about voting rights and people being able to get to the polls and have their voice, because we're making a lot of assumptions when we talk about people moving people to the vote here. And that's an important issue that we cannot lose in this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tammy Johnson is Race and Public Policy Director for the Applied Research Center and contributor to Color Lines magazine. Emil Guillermo is a columnist for Asian Week and a blogger at amok.com. And Earl Afari Hutchinson is political analyst and a syndicated commentator. This is Upfront, Dispatches from the New Majority. I am Sandeep Roy. San Francisco is one of the most desired locations to live in the U.S. It has the third highest median income in the country, but next to the world-class restaurants, the bustling bars and theaters, thousands of San Franciscans eke out a life in cockroach-infested, leaky, single-room occupancy hotels. They might have a roof over their heads at night, but only just. In 2008, Shane Bauer received first place for an independent audio slideshow features for his story about life in San Francisco's single-room occupancy hotels, or SROs, in the NPPA's Best of Photojournalism contest. He joins us on Upfront to talk about poverty hotels. Shane, welcome and congratulations.
Hi, thanks.
So what is an SRO technically?
SRO stands for Single Resident Occupancy Hotel. It's a hotel that people live in. It's a residential hotel. They're typically about 6 by 10 foot rooms. They in San Francisco cost anywhere between $600 to $1,000 a month.
And about how many of these hotels are there in San
Francisco? There's about 500 in San Francisco. There's about 30,000 people living in them, which is about 4% of the city's population.
And who are the people who typically end up living in SROs?
It's a mix. There's families living in SROs, there's working people living in SROs, and there's people that are just one step away from homelessness that are on government assistance. There's, you know, people that have disabilities, mental and physical. There's immigrants. There's people that have just arrived to the city. It's really a pretty big mix of people.
And why do people go to SROs as opposed to just renting or going into boarding houses?
Typically because they can't afford to live in an apartment. A studio apartment in San Francisco is going to be around at least $1,200 a month, plus first and last month's rent, plus a credit check, which for somebody who has been homeless for any amount of time is going to be virtually impossible. So there's kind of a gap between being on the street and being in even affordable housing. Affordable housing in San Francisco is geared to families of four making between $72,000 and $90,000 a year, which is just another planet for somebody who's lived on the street. So there's kind of a market that's been cornered in between that for people that can get anywhere close to living in a place like that.
Now, unlike, say, panhandlers on the street or the people who's sleeping in doorways, living out of shopping carts, SROs, they kind of keep poverty out of sight because mm-hmm. people are going home at night. How did you first really get exposed to them and get interested in the topic?
The first time somebody mentioned an SRO to me was shortly before I started the project. And, you know, they said SRO. I said, what's that? And they explained it to me. And I had never, you know, I've lived in the area for 10 years and I'd never known that anything like that existed in San Francisco. And a lot of people don't, which is part of why I was interested, because there's so many people living in that situation. There's a lot of poor people in San Francisco. It's a really rich city. And it was something that I felt, you know, people should see more of.
I wanted to play a clip from your audio slideshow where one of the residents describes conditions in the SRO.
Most of the people who come here, poor, won't stay in these hotels because a lot of them are just a little single bed with bed bugs all over it and mice running around and the rug ain't been vacuumed when they put you in there, and the view is a urinated plastered wind well. The toilets are all overflowing, the ceiling is leaking sewer water. This is depressing. I would kill myself.
That's a clip from, I guess, Shane Bauer's audio slideshow about SROs in the city, hotel poverty. In that clip, we heard the resident talk about what the SRO really looked like. What did you find the hardest to take about life there?
A lot of the people that I was around that were in SROs are in really difficult situations. You know, that person, for example, had just come off the streets and she didn't like living inside and was having a really hard time living inside. There's a lot of people that are, you know, on drugs, mostly to kind of, what they tell me is to kind of deal with the situation they're in. It's hard to cope with. There's a lot of sickness, too. I mean, a lot of physical difficulties.
You have photographs, in fact, of people taking drugs, though you can't see the faces.
Uh-huh.
And then you have photographs of people's desks, their walls, and it's pretty grimy. Did people mind somebody coming in and taking photographs of that kind of deprivation?
Well, the people that I photographed didn't. You know, I would always get permission from people ahead of time, and most of the people that I photographed, I went back to several times, and they were really welcoming of me being there and were kind of happy to get a bit of their story out and their situation and just to kind of let the larger public see the situation they're stuck in.
And they were happy initially as well, or were they suspicious initially?
You know, it was pretty mixed. There was definitely some people that were suspicious. You know, I had some people that would let me come in their room and kind of hang out and just joke around, and then they'd repeatedly ask me if I was, you know, with the FBI or the police or something. But people loosened up after, you know, I spent some time with them.
Did people actually themselves get involved in the project?
Not in the production of it, just in the, you know, the audio and that kind of thing. I pretty much would just have them tell me what they wanted to tell me, and that's what ended up in the piece.
And what did they think of it after it was done?
Not everybody's seen it. The reactions were also pretty mixed. I mean, some people were really into it, and others, it was kind of hard for them to see, you know, what that looks like for somebody from the outside like me putting it all together, you know, and what kind of story it comes out to be. It's kind of a sad story.
And now we're entering into possibly a recession. How do you think that is going to impact the lives of people who are already on the margins?
It's really up in the air with San Francisco because it's just a city that's getting more and more expensive and more people are leaving. So, you know, I think a lot more people are going to be in this situation and they're not going to have any place to go. And these hotels themselves are also at risk. I mean, with property the way it is in San Francisco, there's a lot of people pushing to get rid of these places. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that even though these places are grimy and not good places, it's important for them to be there. I mean, if they're not there, then there's really very little place for poor people to live in the center of the city.
And what about the owners and managers of the hotel? You hear a voice, it sounds like an Indian accent. Uh-huh. Did you actually want to photograph some of the owners and managers?
Yeah, I did. Well, the managers, the owners typically are not there, but the managers, you know, mostly didn't want me to photograph them. Some of them, I kind of got on some of their good sides, which is why I was allowed into some of the hotels. But yeah, they're really careful about being photographed.
And do they feel like they're being pushed out of the city?
I didn't get that sense, but, you know, the managers are typically not making that much money themselves either. You know, a lot of them live in hotels. I mean, the managers are the ones that work in the desk, and they're not making a fortune out of this. They're kind of in a similar situation as everyone else, and a lot of them work all day long, every day.
The city has been passing laws to allegedly improve conditions in SROs. Have they worked at all?
Yeah, I mean, there has been some, and a lot of them have been because of people that are living in the SROs, tenants organizing to get, say, fire extinguishers. That actually went through. I mean, they're all fairly minimal standard of living changes, but the problem of the cost is, I mean, that hasn't changed. But there's also, I mean, it used to be that you could be rent for a month and they could make you move, but there's now laws that are protecting residents that give them rent control. So there's people that have been in rooms for 15 years in the same room that are paying what they did, you know, 15 years ago, which has definitely helped a lot of the residents from being shuffled all over the place.
What do you think, after having spent all this time there and done this project, that SROs say about how we as a city deal with urban poverty?
I mean, I think, honestly, that it's kind of pushed aside and the very poor have always been kind of just a group of people that have been kind of pushed around. You know, they're not in a position to kind of really rise up through society. And it's just, it's something that there's very little impetus for dealing with it. So I think there's a lot of just kind of turning the other way and letting it go on.
Thank you. Freelance photographer Shane Bauer's series on life in single-room occupancy hotels, or SROs, in San Francisco won him first place for independent audio slideshow features in the NPPA's Best of Photojournalism contest in 2008. You can check out his pictures on shanebauer.net. That's shanebauer.net. You're listening to Upfront, Dispatches from the New Majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericamedia.org. Sonny Bravo, a young Mexican-American man, comes to live at an apartment complex in Los Angeles when his mother marries a contractor. The apartment in the neighborhood becomes a microcosm of racial tensions, sexual tensions, drugs, the underground economy, all of which Sonny Bravo observes as he sweeps the building, takes out its trash, and paints its sign. The Flowers is the latest novel by Penn Hemingway and Guggenheim Award winner Dagoberto Gil. He joins us on Upfront. Welcome to Upfront.
Oh, thanks so much for having me here.
Now, the apartment as a microcosm of life has been used by many different writers. What were you hoping to do with The Flowers?
Do it better than anybody. I think you just said it. That's exactly what I was hoping to do, is just capture various windows into various worlds. And
where did the idea come from?
Those of us have lived in apartment complexes like that know the circumstance well.
So describe to us a little bit about who is Sonny and who is his mother.
Well, Sonny's a 15-year-old boy who, in my opinion, is also like just all of us as men. The first time we're thinking as men is when we're 15. And so Sonny is the sort of essence of being a man, the beginning point. So he's a boy who's trying to grow up and learning that here's the world in front of him and this is what he's dealing with. His mom is just this kind of beautiful, a little bit troubled woman, as are all the characters in the book, though. They're all troubled.
So let's actually hear a little bit from the book. Why don't you introduce the section?
Now his mom has remarried a man named Cloyd Longpre, and now, you know, they're both kind of adjusting to life with Cloyd, the Cloyd, as he begins to call him. I tried to tell my mom, but she didn't hear me. She wasn't dressed for listening, or like she had been in the kitchen for very long, or like she was planning to stay there either. It seemed to me she was wearing another new dress, and she was smelling washed and bath-oiled and lotioned and misted, and the high heels were glossier and redder than her lipstick. She was opening American cans of Mexican salsa. "He doesn't even know I buy este chile at the grocery store," she told me. "He thinks I make it. He even tells everybody I do." "You do make it," I said, "or you could." She crinkled her face at me like I'd suggested she go out like jogging or something. "You think I should cook for him day and night like he wants?" I tried to think of what she did all day, now that she didn't have to work. "What's it for?" I asked. "It's for some client, something to snack on while they're drinking beer and talking about their business. He says it's for a big contract. I think it's a whole housing development." "That sounds big," I said. She made one of those as if she cared about that part. "Like it would make him act like he has one extra dime to spare," she said. This was new complaining. She'd made some new move. At first I got to thinking like, oh no. And then I got to thinking like, all right. Do you know what he told me this morning? She said. Oh yeah, of course I do. Do you know what he told me? She asked again like I hadn't heard any of it the first time. I answered no, even though I didn't feel like it. He told me again that I was using too much toilet paper. I wondered what any of this was really about, where it was really going. No, that's not right. I didn't wonder. I only wished I didn't have to hear any of it. Not in so many words, she said. Just, I think you need to buy some toilet paper when you go to the store. Or maybe he was talking about me not going to the grocery store enough. I don't know.
Thank you. That is from The Flowers, the new novel by Dagoberto Gilb. Now, you've written about your own mother in The New Yorker. Was Sylvia inspired in part by her?
I suppose that's an unavoidable comparison. I think it's also unavoidable to write about your own sort of personal history. I can't write about growing up with a father because I didn't really grow up with a father. I can write about growing up with a stepfather because I did grow up with a couple, three. And so I know about those. And so, yeah, I also kind of have stepfathers in there, but they're not my real stepfather.
Cloyed.
And this mother, I mean, in a certain respect, she has a percentage of what my mother would be. And yeah, I didn't grow up with an ugly mother. I'm the ugly mother. But anyway, she herself wasn't ugly. And so Sylvia is not ugly. And my mother was both better and worse than Sylvia here.
And your mother actually came here without papers?
Oh, yeah.
Where did she end up? Why did she come here?
Well, you know, the land, you know, Los Angeles used to be part of the Spanish land grant area. And there's a whole history of Mexican people living in California. She came across very specifically, however, it's kind of a great story. I had a great aunt who at 18, she was an opera star in Mexico. And she has a great story. Her mother was like one of those 14-year-old women who married a man almost 60, and they had like six or seven children. She was the youngest, and so by the time she's at the age, he's out of the picture, and the mother was working very hard to figure out what to do, but put her in the best places. And the Mexican government put her on a tour.
This is your great aunt.
My great aunt. Put her on a tour, and she ended up in Hollywood. She even sang at Mary Pickford's and opened the Greek Theater. Her name was Raquel Nieto. So my great-aunt moved to L.A. in Hollywood. She was the Mexican at Paramount Studios. And so my grandmother followed her here to Los Angeles. And the awkward part is that she also became the señora of the man who owned this industrial laundry next door. And so my grandmother was there. My mother grew up. The one romantic story I ever heard from my father, who worked at the industrial laundry, he was the floor super. My father was the Spanish-speaking Anglo. He grew up in East Los Angeles. And he started working there when he was 13, worked there 49 years. Anyway, his romantic story, the only thing I ever heard, he said, oh, yeah, she grew up next door, and I watched her grow up, and then I married her.
Okay. And, you know, there's this really funny scene in the segment that you read where Sylvia is opening the can of store-bought chili and her husband, Cloyd, is so proud of her salsa-making capabilities. Growing up in Los Angeles, how much did you tussle with these issues of, you know, am I Mexican enough? Am I too Mexican? Not enough?
I just think that's the sort of barrier reef of all Chicanos. We all go through this in varying forms of, it's just being Mexican-American, and that is your basic state of consciousness. It's the constant battle. In the movement days, is who's more Indio than who, you know, all these things, whose Spanish is better than whose, all these kind of things, just the basic of it. What I'm trying to do with this is sort of like bring out not the sort of Aztec part of us, is just sort of the American, goofy American part that is all of us. You know, sneaking a taco at Taco Bell is pretty common. But it's not like, oh, I don't want anybody to know I actually crunched that.
But what was your own relationship to books, for example, growing up? I read an interview where you said the only writers you knew were all dead ones.
That was basically what I believe there would be openings since I was writing and I didn't know anybody else was writing anything. I didn't read books. It's funny because, in fact, I don't think I had any friends whose family, in the house, there were books. It was just non-existent. On the other hand, I always thought I'd come from a more educated family because my mother had a couple books around, and until one day I opened one time and just to see where she'd been reading, and the spine was a little crinkled, and you see where she read, and it was the dirty parts.
What was it, Harold Robbins?
Sort of like that. It was basically that kind of book. I was like, well, I don't have to tell anybody. She... I thought it was pretty funny.
But is it true that you used to steal foreign books from the foreign literature section in bookstores?
Not just foreign. Oh, that's really one of my more embarrassing... When I was in college at UC Santa Barbara, I would go to this Isla Vista bookstore. I loved that bookstore. I'd go every day and just bag one or two. It was just terrible. I loved them, though. It wasn't because I was, like, selling. I just wanted them. I just wanted to caress them and, like, read whatever was in them. And
you didn't care what book it was?
No. I wanted to read the book. I wanted every one that I ever bagged. And it was all for the best intention. And I know the owner, he'd see me. I mean, I would buy them, too. But, you know, I'd probably like a third.
Buy two, get one for free.
More buy one and get two or three for free. It was worse. I was bad. I admit it. And this is while I'm in.
Are you studying religion at this
it's
time?
It's embarrassing. I know. But I was an undergrad then. Anyway, and then I'll never forget, I'm standing there, and one day I did it, and the owner, there was a upper deck, he looked up, and he saw me do it. And I was so humiliated, so just, oh, my God. And he was so kind, he told me, just never come back. And it was like the worst broken love affair. I couldn't believe how bad I was. But there was a well-known interviewer who had the same kind of kleptomania. I won't even mention the name. And I have to say, when I heard that, it made me recall that I had this problem for like several years. And I realized that he just loved books. I mean, of all the sort of addictions, isn't that one of the sweeter ones that you could have? It's about books. They were used books, no less, by the way.
But, you know, I've always been struck that, especially when we categorize writers now, immigrant writer, Latino writer, South Asian writer, so much of that kind of hyphenated writing, as it were, has been about nostalgia, homeland, and a lot of them are by women who are writing. And you don't see very many sort of working class heroes in many of these novels.
I just think the writing industry has just abandoned those people. But the fact is that to be a writer these days, you virtually have to go to college and study it like a geology. And to do that, it requires a certain type. And where it didn't used to be that, it used to be people had adventures and they wrote about their adventures, the lives that were around them and that they'd experienced. And it just doesn't exist. So what's basically left is the nostalgia for a place, you know, in the past, your parents' working class lives, your imaginary life in some place that you've never been. And I think we've lost this. And I think it's reflected in a lot of ways, and it no less in literature than anywhere else.
What about the Latino aspect? Latinos are so much more in the news these days, whether it's the swing vote that everybody wants or the largest minority group and how to be marketed to them. Do you think the Latino experience is being written about in more interesting ways now?
Well, we go through different swings like everybody, and we've gone through what I would consider like a sarape, huarache phase, where there's this obligation to sort of dress up and dress up the literature, and we have folkloric interests all the time, and we have to have magical stuff happening. And I think the vast majority of people that live their lives don't experience that. And what I do is I try to write about, like, jobs, and you know that this person is Mexican or Mexican American, or that's what I write about, and those are the people that tell me stories about not going to church. And I think that's what a lot of us experience, actually, not eating perfectly, not making tortillas, and not having to apologize about it, maybe being the same conversations that all people have when they Americanize or Mexicanize. Even in Mexico itself, people are going through these very same experiences of losing their sense of the tortilla. And
And we all somehow survived to tell that tale.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Flowers is the latest novel by Dagoberto Gilb. This is Upfront. I'm Sandeep Roy. Consuelo Luz was raised in the Philippines, Greece, Spain, Italy, Peru by Chilean Cuban parents. And she studied in Cambridge and New York and eventually ended up in New Mexico. So it's not surprising that her music taps into many musical strains. In her latest album, Adio, she uses ancient spiritual folk songs, but gives them her own melodies. And she joins us on Upfront. Welcome to Upfront, Consuelo.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Whenever people can't really classify music, we just shove it into one giant bucket and call it world music. Yes. How would you describe your music?
Yes, I have a hard time describing my music. Like you said, I have a lot of different influences. So I sing in many different styles, really. And then I also write my own music. And I think we're living in a time of great creative fervor in which new art forms are coming into form and new music is being created. World is coming together. You have all kinds of fusions going on. So it's very, very difficult to classify music. In this case, it's world music because it is influenced by different places across the ocean, I would say, because it originates in the Middle Eastern and Mediterranean and Spanish era when the Jews lived. This was in the medieval times, and they lived in Spain for 1,000 years, and they developed a culture and a language. And in fact, this culture of Spain is largely based on the Jewish and the Arab, too, of course. They lived there side by side for many centuries. So the Sephardic Jews are the ones that settled in the Mediterranean, in Africa, and in Spain. And in Spain, they developed a language called Ladino, which was an old Spanish medieval language that they sort of appropriated. And they helped originate flamenco, and they influenced by also the gypsies later, and of course, the Moorish music. So this is the origin of what I do in this album, Adio, is the Sephardic music. But because my own background is South American and contemporary, I bring it into the present.
So let's actually hear
a long answer to your question.
Well, let's hear a song. We were going to play this melody called Mar de Leche.
Mar de Leche.
Do you want to introduce it for us?
Yeah, Mar de Leche means sea of milk. There's some beautiful poetical imagery in these songs. And this is a love ballad, which would have been sung in Spain during medieval times by the Jews. And it's in this language, Ladino, which sounds like Spanish, but it's a little different. And it's a love ballad. It's about well, if the sea were made of milk, I would become a fisherman and fish my pain with songs of love. Let me climb into your nest, sweet dove. Those who sleep alone are cursed.
Okay, let's hear that.
Sí, la marea de leche, yo me haría un pescador, yo me haría un pescador. De leche, yo me haría un pescador, oh, oh. Pescaría mis dolores, 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 con palabritas de amor.
That's the song Mar de Leche from the album Adio by my guest Consuelo Luz. Now, how did you get exposed to or interested in Sephardic music?
Well, throughout my childhood, I was raised Catholic because we were raised in very Catholic countries. We lived in Catholic countries all over the world, as you said at the beginning. But my parents were not religious at all. And my mother used to mention that we're Jewish from way back, but in an offhand way. She wasn't religious. So I grew up kind of with this idea in the background. And then many, many years later, when I was married and raising a child, and raising the child Jewish because my husband was Jewish and I was being introduced to this Jewish world. And at the same time, I was living in the mountains of northern New Mexico where there was research going on that was exposing the fact that probably 70% of the Hispanics in northern New Mexico who have been there for centuries, who came up from Mexico in the 1500s, are descended from Jews.
And how come?
Because they were fleeing. They fled the Inquisition first to Mexico. And 100 years later, the Inquisition came to Mexico, which is a whole other interesting political story of why it came to Mexico. And it was used as a political tool for the Spanish king to drive the Portuguese out of Mexico. If that hadn't happened, they'd be speaking Portuguese in Mexico. So it was interesting. They used the Inquisition as a political tool to drive the Portuguese Jews out because the Portuguese Jews had become very powerful. And they used this religious, in quotation marks, that's what we do, it seems what human beings do. They use religion in these terrible political ways. So a lot of these Jews tried to escape Mexico and came up to the north, which was in that time was Mexican territory or Spanish territory, and then it became Mexican. And they created communities there.
Well, it's one thing to be raising your child as part of Jewish heritage and in Jewish traditions, but then how did you get exposed to these really ancient songs, the songs that you're singing here, the ones that are in Ladino?
Well, I was part of a Jewish group up in the mountains in northern New Mexico, and a woman there had some songs. I sang in Spanish since I was a child, and she came upon these songs, these prayers. They were Jewish prayers, and she said, "Look, they have these Jewish prayers, but they seem to be in Spanish. Maybe you could learn some and sing them at some of our gatherings." So I started learning them and discovered the Sephardic music, and of course discovered that it wasn't actually Spanish; it was this ancient Ladino language. And I fell in love with the music, and then sang.
So were the prayers already set to music, or was that something you had to compose?
No, there were. When I sing this music, I do a combination. I take these old melodies and old lyrics in Hebrew and Ladino, and I sing the songs. I adapt musically to a more contemporary kind of style. But also I bring the South American, and I try to retain the flamenco element too, because there was, like I said, that was a large part of the Jewish influence in Spain. So apart from that, I also take a song and will extend it or add a chorus. And then sometimes I will create a whole new song based on old Hebrew text or old Kabbalistic text. Or I will take an old melody and put my own words to it. And so I kind of just, you know, put my own interpretation in there.
And now when you sang these for the first time for the congregation there, had they ever actually heard it sung before?
They hadn't. And this has happened to me a lot. And now, in the last few years, there's more and more awareness of this culture. American Jewish culture has been very Ashkenazi-sized. But the original Jews that came to North America were Sephardic Jews, and they really predominated for a long time, for 200 years. Before the 1800s was when the Ashkenazi started coming in. But the Sephardic Jews were very prominent in the East, the first synagogue was in Rhode Island and in New York, and they were members of the stock exchange. There was a Sephardic Jew who was a Supreme Court justice. They helped fund the American Revolution, and they were very instrumental in the creation of this country, actually. But then in the 1800s, the Ashkenazi Jews started coming from Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, and they came in such numbers that they just overtook the culture. And then, as we know, now American Jewish culture is Ashkenazi, and it's in the music, the klezmer music, and the Hasidic traditions, and the matzah balls, and you know, which is the Northern and Eastern European that emerged from more the German and the Russian Jews.
So, what was it like for these people? Can you describe it a little bit? To hear somebody singing these kind of almost forgotten songs in Latino.
Well, there were two things that happened. One was the complete surprise and shock. Not even many American Jews don't even realize or know that there is this whole other branch of Judaism, which is the kind of the root of Judaism, really, the Sephardic Jews, and not acquainted with it. And so, first of all, is a shock. What? That music that sounds Spanish or sounds Latin or flamenco, that's Jewish? You know. So there's that first thing of, wow, that's Jewish. And then there's a whole other reaction, which is very deep and profound, because this music is very powerful. It's this sort of, I see it as this hidden energy that's been waiting, and it's coming out now, and more people are singing it, and people are appreciating this whole other aspect of Judaism, of the Jewish culture.
I wanted to go out with the song Kabbalah Torah, but before that, I wanted to just ask you, having worked with this music, having worked with these songs, sung them, recording this album, what has that done for your own spiritual journey?
Well, it's deepened it, and I've come to my own understanding of what being Jewish is and what the Jewish tradition comes from, and the deep, deep, profound, mystical, spiritual root of it. And for me, in this song that we're going to hear, is I took the words from the old ancient text of the Zohar, which is one of the books of the Kabbalah, which was actually written during this medieval time in Spain when the Jews were so prominent there. And they, for me, represent this understanding of spirituality that, and these sacred texts that we have in not only the Jewish religion, but of course Islam and Christian and all the sacred texts that we have, that what people tend to do is interpret them literally, and then we get into a lot of trouble. So for me, this is what I found in Judaism, that the true core of Judaism goes beyond the literal interpretation. And in the song, it quotes Zohar, saying that you have to go underneath, that the truth, the mystical truth of a religion is like the wine in the jar. The words are the jar. And one line, in fact, says that only fools just believe in the stories and know nothing more.
So let's hear it. Kabbalah Torah from the album Adio by my guest Consuelo Luz.
Sublime words, sublime secrets. The body of the Torah is clothed in garments made of stories, stories which only go so far. Fools of the world, look at the garments. They know nothing more. The communion of Israel is the body that precedes the soul. The soul is the beauty of Israel, who is real Torah. So Torah must sit in this garment, as wine must sit in a jar. Come and see the holy ancient one never done. All is connected, this one to that one, this one to that one. Vengan a ver el sagrado eterno de nosotros. Todo está conectado, uno a otro, uno a otro.
Consuelo Luz's latest album is called Adio. You can find more information on her website, consueloluz.com. That's consueloluz.com. You can hear Consuelo Luz sing at the Angora Benefit Concert on June 24th, and you can find more information about that on angorabenefitconcert.com. For listening to Upfront, dispatches from the new majority, interethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. Upfront is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericamedia.org and click on Upfront Radio. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Mary Ambrose directs the show. Upfront is produced at the KALW studio in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sandeep Roy.